I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Kurt Ammerman. He is a mechanical engineer at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you.
So your area of expertise is wind power, wind generation, and that is so far a pretty small sector of the American energy economy, but the potential for it is absolutely huge.
Right. So right now we generate a little over 2% of our electricity in the United States using wind power, but we have the potential to generate 10 times the amount of electricity that we use with wind power in this country.
And so what does that amount to? In other words, could we generate, in theory, just given the amount of wind and space that we have, could we generate half of our electricity from wind, all of it?
We could easily generate half of our electricity from wind, but to do that, we would have to seriously modernize the electric grid in the United States, and we'd also have to add some type of storage so that when the wind doesn't blow, we still have electricity.
So given current wind power technology, what are the strong points and what are the weak points?
So strong points are this is something that we can generate domestically within the United States, and therefore we would not be dependent on a foreign source of energy like we are on foreign oil. Also, wind is clean and renewable. As long as the sun shines, we will have wind, and there is no greenhouse gas emissions. So we can use wind power to displace traditional fossil forms of fuel like greenhouse gas emitting coal and oil. So it's very positive.
What are the, at this point, disadvantages of wind? In other words, has wind technology gotten to the point where, first of all, it's competitive, that the actual ways of doing the energy generation are as efficient as they can be? I mean, where do we sort of stand as a technology?
Right. So modern wind turbine, using it to generate electricity, has only been done for about 20, 25 years on a utility scale. And so the technology has changed dramatically over the course of those 25 years. Wind power initially was very expensive, was not competitive with fossil forms of fuel, but it's the price of wind energy has dropped dramatically, and now it's very competitive. And in addition, we right now have a federal production tax credit of about 2 cents per kilowatt hour. So we're federally subsidizing wind, but so it's right on the edge of being able to stand on its own 2 feet. And so
Being able to stand on its own 2 feet basically means competing with coal.
That's right. And in the long run, if we really put in the total cost that we pay for coal, not just the price that we pay for it, but the carbon emission from it, and if we start putting in the technology to clean up coal, then wind is going to be by far cheaper than coal.
So if we were to build in the social costs of using coal, wind would already be more than competitive.
That's correct.
Very interesting. So the way a coal plant works is basically it's a giant boiler of water. How does do windmills boil water? How do they actually generate electricity?
So windmills, the wind blows and it strikes the turbine blades that causes them to rotate. That rotational energy is transferred by a shaft to an electric generator. And so it goes directly to generating voltage and current that gets put on the electrical grid. And so with traditional forms of energy like coal and nuclear, there is a large amount of cooling required to take the waste heat away. And so they are not only greenhouse gas. Coal is not only a greenhouse gas emitter, but it also uses a lot of water. And wind doesn't require any water.
One of the objections that people make to wind energy is that it kills birds. I was interested to find, I went to your lecture last week here in Santa Fe, that the greatest killer of birds, human-caused killer of birds, are buildings, and that windmills actually account for a a very tiny percentage of bird killings.
Yeah. So early on, when wind was first deployed, they did not take into consideration the path of migratory birds and raptors. And so initially there was some bird kill that raised alarms. But now every modern wind farm, part of the siting process, is taking into consideration the wildlife and birds. And so you're correct. By far, wind is a very small contributor to the total number of birds that are killed each year related to human activity.
So is it actually law that you can't put up a utility-scale wind electricity-generating installation in a migratory bird corridor? I mean, you're not allowed to do it, or?
So, honestly, I don't know the answer to that question. I know that for each siting activity that goes on, there are a variety of concerns. Some of them relate to that local area, and included that in that is the look at what kind of environmental impact they would have with regard to birds and bats.
Bats are also vulnerable.
Bats are also vulnerable, and so that's something that the industry is doing. They're putting money into research to find out ways to mitigate and minimize bird and bat kill with wind turbines.
Another concern that people have is noise. How noisy are they? How do you measure that? It's just a function of distance from the windmill installation?
Right. So that's another area of research that is ongoing with wind turbines. In addition to making them more efficient, is to making them quieter. And there are limitations on how close you can place a wind turbine relative to residential areas, for example. And so the minimum distance is about 300 meters. And at 300 meters, the noise emitted from a wind turbine is about the same as your refrigerator in your house.
What about the noise emitted by 100 wind turbines all next to each other?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
So we're talking to Kurt Ammerman about windmills, wind turbines, wind energy. What are some of the big engineering challenges in wind energy right now? I mean, you mentioned energy storage. That's a big one.
So with wind energy, the turbines are designed to last 20 years. And however, they're only warrantied for about two. And after their warranty expires, they begin to fail. And they have reliability and maintainability issues. Although they've come a long way, they're like 98% reliable on average, that last 2% is still very costly to the owner-operators. And so some of the problems are gearbox failures, for example. The wind turbine turns at a very slow rate, about 25 RPMs, but the generator wants a very fast spinning rotor. And so there's a gearbox between the rotor and the generator that increases the speed of that shaft speed. And the gearboxes are seeing a failure, and that's very expensive because those gearboxes are at the top of the pole where the rotor is. And
so you have to go 80 meters into the air or whatever it is?
That's right, and you have to use a crane to do that. And so that's a very expensive replacement. So gearboxes are failing before the end of the 20-year operating life, and that's mainly because the loads that go into an operating wind turbine at that scale, these very large sizes, up to 100 meters in diameter, are not well understood. And so that's one of the areas that we're performing research in at Los Alamos, is to try and better understand the real-world loads that a turbine sees.
When you have an area which is windy, there's plenty of them here in New Mexico, the wind blows from different directions. Can the turbine shift to accommodate the wind coming from all different directions?
That's right. So each of the wind turbines has a yaw control, which allows it to rotate to face the prevailing wind direction.
Let's talk for a moment about energy storage. It's a question with wind because it's not windy all the time. It's a question with solar because it's not sunny all the time. Batteries are, at this point in history, somewhat limited in terms of how efficiently they store energy, how much energy they can store, and above all, their cost efficiency. on, especially on a large scale. What are batteries, do you think, the way of the future, or are they looking at other storage technologies?
So the issue of storage is very important for trying to grow a wind industry, also for any renewable like solar energy as well. Right now, if we want to put a large-scale wind on the electric grid, because wind is intermittent and sometimes the wind stops blowing, we have to have traditional power sources to back it up. So we really can't displace coal-fired power plants by putting wind on the grid unless we have storage as well. And so there are a variety of different areas of research in different types of storage. One is batteries, as you mentioned, and they're trying to improve the energy density in batteries. But there are also other very promising avenues of research, some of which are going on at Los Alamos, and that is trying to convert sunlight into chemical energy or turn wind energy into chemical energy. And, for example, you could take water and split it into hydrogen and oxygen and use that hydrogen as a fuel later when the wind's not blowing.
What you're saying makes me think about photosynthesis, which, if my understanding is right, we still don't understand well enough to really reproduce.
Right. So taking electrical energy and converting it into chemical energy is very similar to what plants do. They take solar sunlight and turn it into chemical energy, sugars, that they can then use to grow. And so... we can do that as I mentioned, with water. We can split it through the process called electrolysis into hydrogen and oxygen and use that hydrogen later as a fuel. There are other areas of research that are going on to look at different forms of chemical energy that we could use as a storage medium.
So you're working on this at Los Alamos. Where is most of the research going on in the United States? Is it in our national laboratories? Is industry doing it? How do you all work together?
So there's the wind industry is growing rapidly, and there are a lot of different areas that do research. National labs for sure, and the two primary labs are the National Renewable Energy Lab, NREL, up in Colorado, and Sandia National Lab here in Albuquerque. They've been working in wind for over 30 years. Here at Los Alamos, we're kind of new on the scene, but we have some unique technologies that we can bring to bear to solve some of the problems in the industry. And industry is also doing a lot of research on their own and also in academia at various universities. There's a tremendous amount of research going on right now.
And how do you deal with the, on the one hand, desire for openness and communication, on the other hand, intellectual property concerns?
So the industry players themselves, like General Electric, who's one of the major wind turbine producers in the world, they very much value the intellectual property and the competitive advantage they have with the research they perform. What we do at the national labs, we try to make available on a broad scale to anybody who can use it, but also we in some areas protect our property, protect our intellectual property so that it would be of value to a U.S. manufacturer, for example, so that they could compete with international wind turbine manufacturers. So there's a variety of ways to do that. A lot of what we do, we make available publicly. Some of what we do, we patent so that we can then provide it to the American wind industry.
Where in the world are the greatest advances coming from? In other words, are they from here, or is some other country the world leader in wind technology?
So it's mainly in the United States and in Denmark are some of the world leaders. China is coming onto the scene rapidly, but because the industry is growing so tremendously and because wind is distributed all over the world, there's advantages to almost any country developing their own wind industry. So we're seeing that in South America. We're seeing it across Europe. And there's many players in the international wind market right now.
When I was looking at the lecture that you gave in Santa Fe, you showed a map of where the greatest, well, the windiest areas in this country are that would be ripe for utility scale electric production from wind. And it's really just like a band down the middle of the United States, including at least the eastern half of New Mexico and the Great Plains, all the way up from north to south of this country. If we were to produce vast amounts of wind energy in these areas without hurting birds and bats and without being too noisy and all those things that are concerns to people, how would we get that energy to New York and California and Florida and things like that?
Well, we would have to provide additional transmission capacity in the United States to get the energy where we can produce it in the Great Plains to the place where we use it the most, which is on the East and West Coast. And that's part of what we need to do anyway in modernizing our electric grid. But we would have to add that capacity in order to transfer the electricity.
Talk more about the electric grid. What state is it in now, and what is necessary to modernize it? In other words, are we talking about putting in entirely new technologies in order to modernize the existing grid?
So I think right now with the electric grid, it's starting to age. It's part of our national infrastructure. It's starting to age, show its age, and it's in need of upgrades and modernization. And we're not going to be able to do that all at once, but as we do it, we're going to start adding what we call smart technology for a smart grid that would be able to manage intermittent renewables like wind and solar that could come online rapidly and also drop off rapidly. And so the grid would have to be able to manage that. And in addition, the smart grid would put computers on our home meters and computers on some of our major electrical appliances so that we can load level from power stations to manage areas of or times of peak demand that really put a lot of pressure and stress on the grid.
What would that look like?
So, for example, on a summer day in Dallas, Texas, when it's over 100 degrees and everybody turns on their air conditioners in the afternoon, the grid may prevent you from running your electric clothes dryer till after 5 o'clock when the demand starts to ease. And so that would enable the grid to handle that capacity and manage it in a way that keeps it from causing rolling blackouts or brownouts or something like that during times of peak demand.
What is really striking to me is that the United States uses, what is it, one-fifth of the world's energy every year?
That's correct. We use 20% of the energy that's consumed worldwide. And, you know, there's 7 billion people in the world right now, and we're on our way to 9 billion. And that growth in the population is mainly in, is going to occur in developing countries. And so those developing countries would like to have a standard of living similar to the United States. And
what does that mean? Like, what are they talking about? They want to have what objects or what does standard of living mean?
Well, we enjoy a very high standard of living. We've got our laptop computers. We've got all of our modern electrical appliances, our cell phones and our televisions and automobiles. And all of those are very energy intensive devices. And that really improves our quality of life. And in a third world country or a developing country that would like to improve their quality of life, maybe they're doing their laundry by hand, and a washer and dryer would just be fabulous. Mainly improving your quality of life means having more energy available and consuming more energy.
Why do we use so much more than our European counterparts, who seem to be doing just fine in terms of quality of life?
So I think in part because it's a paradigm. In this country, we've always had low-cost, plentiful energy. And so because of that, we haven't had to conserve energy. We haven't had to be efficient. And now we're starting to see the impacts of that with global warming and with a limited supply of energy in certain cases, like gasoline prices going up because of a squeeze in the oil market. And for example, take buildings. Buildings in this country use 50% of all the electricity we consume. That's the energy to build them and then to power them, lights, computers, that kind of thing. And we could easily reduce that with energy efficiency. And those technologies exist today, but we just haven't done it. And I think it's just because we've got to change our mindset.
My sense from having spoken to people who work at Los Alamos over the years is that for many years, the people working at the lab have understood, and in fact, there's been, you have scientists coming from all over the world to speak to your scientists and engineers, have understood that human-caused climate change is a reality and we need to deal with it. And the rest of the world is still sort of, I mean, I went to some of those hearings here in New Mexico on the carbon cap, and there were people there saying, well, climate change isn't real, and even if it is, it's not caused by human beings. Can you speak to that a little bit from the point of view of an informed person working at the lab?
So scientific consensus worldwide is that temperature is rising, and it's fairly clear that that's associated with the increase in the amount of greenhouse gases that are accumulating in our atmosphere. We've been taking, scientists worldwide, we've been taking samples of, for example, ice cores in the Antarctic, and we can go back hundreds of thousands of years and look at the gas bubbles that are trapped in the ice and see what the atmosphere has been like for several hundred thousand years. And you can see when the ice ages occur and when warming occurs. And right now, we have more methane and CO2 in our atmosphere by far than we've ever had in the history going back 500,000 years. And that is directly attributable to the modern industrial revolution and the number of people we have on the planet and the amount of energy we use, and that is raising global temperature. This past year, 2010, was tied with the warmest year on Earth and worldwide. And as a result of that, we're starting to see more intense storms around the planet. We're seeing a heat wave like we saw in the Soviet Union this summer. That's going to impact our ability to provide food, to grow crops for this growing planet. And it's also going to raise global sea level. And so, while you can't say it without a doubt that humans cause global warming, there's overwhelming evidence to the case.
We're talking to Kurt Ammerman. I suppose some people may be surprised that Los Alamos, the nuclear place, is dealing with wind. How come you're doing that?
So, we do research every year, internally funded research on whatever we would like, as long as it supports our lab mission and it supports the goals of the Department of Energy. And we've chosen wind because one of the missions at the lab is energy security for our country, and wind directly relates to that. But the other reason is because we have some unique technologies and capabilities in people that we can bring to bear to solve problems in the wind industry, and one of those is high-performance supercomputing. We have these large supercomputers that we use to do simulations of nuclear weapons, and we can use those to model multiple wind turbines all at once in a wind farm, and so that we can see the interaction between turbines and also optimally place them so that they can maximize their energy output. We also have very good experimental capabilities that we can use to take data around a wind turbine and feed that into our simulations to validate those simulations, to calibrate them. And so we've got some unique capabilities, and we bring those to bear. Also, there are other labs that work, as we've talked about, the National Renewable Energy Lab in Sandia. They work in wind, and we're not competing with them. We're actually collaborating well with each of those two laboratories and leveraging all of our strengths together to solve some of these challenges.
Kurt Ammerman is a mechanical engineer at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Kurt, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.